One.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Alma Podcast. I am your host, Coco Rubio, hanging out in beautiful downtown Augusta here at the luscious studios of Augusta Podcast, hanging out with David over there. How you doing, David?
I'm doing good.
Thanks for having us.
We're excited for you guys. This flowery shirt sitting in front of me.
Oh, yeah. That's the man right there. The purpose of Alma Podcast is to kind of promote local music and art here in Augusta, Georgia. And ALMA is it's actually an acronym for Augusta Live Music and Arts. It's also Spanish for soul. And that's why I took the name. My guest today is an Augusta legend. I want to introduce you to Mr. Keith Jenkins. Keith, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastically well.
It's good to have you, man.
It's good to be had.
That's right. Keith, legend. That's a nickname that I've heard, you know, tossed around by some of our friends. Yeah. Who gave you that? Who gave you that nickname?
So he was right off the bat, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That I play in this wedding band. And when I just gotten in the band, it's like 2008. And a drummer from here, David Swanigan, who's living in Nashville, hooked me up. He was friends with the drummer, and he, you know, said, you want to do this gig? And so got in the band. I was in the band for a couple of months or something. And one day I was sitting there with a sound check or something, the drummer, and I said, his name's Morgan. I said, hey, Morgan, what do Michael Jackson, Isaac Hayes, The Temptations, Bootsy Collins, Dave Matthews, Lenny Kravitz, Usher, Huey Lewis, you know, all have in common, Elton John. And he was like, I don't know what I said. They all played with the legend, Keith Jenkins.
That's awesome. And that's funny.
And so
that's great.
It destroyed him, you know. And so and then I came home. I think I was at Metro or something. I was telling somebody. I told one person that story. That's how the whole thing was.
Yeah,
you know. That was it. I just told one person that. I don't remember who it was, but it,
yeah. It's funny. When I hear you come up sometimes, and you know, they say legend.
Yeah.
And man, I didn't know that. See, that's why we're doing this.
Yeah,
that's
great. Who else would have?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you have some things you have to just go ahead and. It was a joke. It was a total joke. And then, you know, it's so easily mocked. Oh, the legend. You know, I don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean,
I think locally,
I was mocking myself. When
sure,
I did it.
That's what's cool about you, man. But I think it, you know. You are legendary, just, you know, to be known as Mr. James Brown's guitar player. And I mean,
that has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, yeah. For a lot of people here in Augusta, you know, you are that legend. But I want to go further back, Keith, and talk about, like, you know, how did you get to that status? How did you get to being a guitar player? You know, who inspired you to pick up the guitar and learn to play like you play? Take us back, Keith.
Well, that's that's easy, because everything in the early part of my musical trip or whatever important that happened is directly attributed to my brother. It was his idea to get a guitar in the first place one Christmas. And, you know, we were so poor that sometimes we would, opt for a consolidated, like, shared gift, you know? And, this was one such time. He was like, instead of us getting individual things, we're going to get a guitar and an amp, and we'll share it. Which there was nothing about our relationship that would have indicated that that was going to go well, the sharing of something. But so, you know, he was hype about it, and I remember we'd sit there at the eating dinner or whatever, and he would say, "Now we got to write a song." And so we started trying to write a song. It was so dumb. And and he was just all excited and everything. So we get this guitar on layaway from the music shop on Peach Orchard Road, which was right next to Eat a Plenty.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what year is this?
1985, Christmas of 85.
Oh, okay, okay.
But so we've got this no-name Japanese, you know, the early days of Japanese guitars that were terrible. Then they immediately got it together and they, you know, make fantastic stuff. But this was before that. And this is probably from the early 70s or something. I still have it. And we got a little Tronix amp. I've never even heard of that ever again.
Tronix.
Yeah, so the amp and the guitar total was maybe $85. Mm-hmm. But we were so poor that it was on layaway. We didn't get it until February of 86.
Layaway, man.
Is when we actually got our Christmas, this $35 guitar and this little amp. And I thought that I was going to pick it up and play Eruption.
Yeah.
That didn't happen.
It didn't sound like that?
No. And my brother, can we cuss on this thing? Is it G-rated or what?
It's not
it?
Do this podcast, so you know.
Okay. Well,
there's no FCC rules here.
My brother was good at everything that he did, like BMX bikes and shooting pool. In he was impervious to pain, so he could do BMX shit that the guy, he had a couple of tricks that even the pro guys back then couldn't do because he was so unafraid to get hurt. And then he just with video games. We had an ice cream parlor with an arcade in the back of it up the street from our house. You know, that was the beginning of his downfall. And but he was good at all that kind of stuff. And we got that guitar and he picked it up and tried to do something with it. He's fuck this. You know, like he immediately wanted no, like,
not his thing.
He sold me his half of it, his interest
right.
in the guitar. And I was the same way, no knack for it whatsoever. And I had a guitar for the Practicing Musician magazine I bought with some tab people, musicians know what that is. It's like cheap music for guitar players. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to learn some Rat song or something. And
So you were right there in the mid-80s.
Yeah, and I made straight A's all through school, through the first half of sixth grade, and then second half, we got that guitar, F's.
Oh, no.
Like my grades plummeted.
And you were in the school of rock.
Yeah, and I didn't care about anything but playing that guitar. And the guy across the street growing up, his name was Chris Nix. Mm-hmm. He's in Nashville now. Mm-hmm. And he was another reason I thought that I would be good is because when he was 12, he could play Eruption.
Yeah.
He was damn near as good as he is now when he was 14 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you're talking about Chris because he was
the
man.
And he was across the street.
Yeah.
Well, he used to babysit me and my brother. He's 5 years older than me. And he was kind of like my protector from my brother. You know, my brother, we'd be playing football and in the yard, you know, my brother would tackle me and he would just start punching me. And, you know, just Chris was like, oh, hold up. You know, like, right. So I idolized him. I met him the day we moved in 1981 in that house. And then I idolized Chris. And he had kind of gone away, lived with his dad or something, wasn't around. And then one night, we heard, you know, some music coming from over there. And, my brother, once again, my brother said, this is like the same time period. He said, you know who that is? I said, who? He said, that's Chris. They're over there jamming. We're going over there. I said, I'm not going over there. He was like, come on, man, we're going. I said, I want to go. He said, if you don't go, I'm going to go get our guitar and take it. I said, no, don't do that. You know, I was mortified. And so he said, come on. We went over there, him and a guy named Jeff Jordan, a real legend, you know, the generation ahead of Chris, were over there just playing through some little amps, like a PV Rage and some little practice amp.
Yeah, yeah.
On the back porch. And there was a couple people sitting around, his mom and a few friends, and they were just ripping on the guitar, and it was mind-blowing. I mean, it sounded like more than just two dudes playing guitar. I don't know if they had, like, a boombox or something. They were playing over tunes or playing over nothing, but it was – that was a big – I mean, it's just seared into my brain and reconnected with Chris, you know, but still didn't really approach him about anything. And then another same time period where we grew up, around the corner, Finnessy Road, there's an old drive-in movie theater. And it had shut down in the late 70s. And I think for the last couple of weeks, the guy just played porn on the big screen. We'd ride by like...
Southside.
Yeah, like, what is that, you know? And but it had shut down. The screen was still up, and the concession area was still there. And then they decided... Somebody put together this thing. They were going to have bands on a Friday night. And my brother said, they're having bands over at the drive-in Friday night. We're going. And I said, okay. And I said, what about, you know, how are we going to get over there? He said, we're going to walk. I said, what about mama? He's like, don't worry about it. My brother could talk anybody into anything. And so she let us walk over there. And
they had some bands playing.
They had bands playing, man. And it was amazing. It was like one of these things where this abandoned area had just sprung to life. There was kids everywhere. The concessions was open. And it was like we went like in a time machine or something. Yeah. Not that that was what was there before. It was a drive-in. But and the bands were outside and Tri-X.
Tri-X. I was going to ask you, who were the bands that were there? Do you remember?
Tri-X was there. Juan, I can't think of his last name. He played drums, and he had, I remember he had a big gash missing out of his ride cymbal, but he had long hair. He looked like a real rocker of the time, and he didn't have a mullet. He had a proper, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So this was late 80s, early 90s?
This is about 86.
86.
Same time period. Yeah, they played Rainbow in the Dark by Dio twice. And there are people around, I don't know if any of them will hear this, but we'll remember. They did it one other week, and then they had to shut that down.
Right.
You know,
right.
Just like Rock and Roll Park that they had in the 70s on, you know, they had two shows.
Over there on Washington Road to talk about some of those old shows. Yeah. I'd like to talk to some of those people, you know, who were involved with that, some of the bands that were playing, because I think, I mean, Augusta has such a rich history with music, and it's just hard to document it. And that's kind of what I want to do with the podcast is document, you know, things that have happened, things that are happening now, you know, what we can look forward to coming up, you know?
Yeah, there were, you know, the sad thing is it, we don't really recognize things at the time as like in the 90s when, you know, there really was nothing down here and we just felt like, oh, there's nothing, man. There was so much stuff in the 90s, so many different little scenes, you know, like the honky tonk was just packed every weekend, if that was your thing.
Gordon Highway.
Yeah, and then you had like Kathmandu, Sidewinder.
Washington Road, you know, all white PA.
This weekend. And they'd come in these touring cover bands, the Dynasty, Sidewinder, four guys and a hot chick singer that doubles on keyboards all weekend, Kathmandu. And you had the post office, of course, the gym mill. My first gig was at the OR.
The operating room. Laney Walker right there by Payne College. Yeah.
Druid Park and Laney Walker.
Druid Park, yep.
I was 14. Me and Travis Petrie and Brian Allen had a little band. And
Wait. Travis and Brian and you were in a band, head of the OR.
Yep, twice. We opened for Doc Guido.
Yes.
And we opened for the Deadbolts.
Yes.
Chris Hohen and Chris Hardy.
Yeah. That's awesome. What was the name of that band?
Oh.
Am I going to have to call Trav? Call Brian and see what's up?
Yeah. It escapes me.
Come on, man.
I'm not doing band names. I'm not doing band names.
The OR was one of the first places I went with my brother, DDA, and he was friends with, I think it was somebody in Doc Guido. And we went, and then later it was fun because they would let, local bands play, and it was fun to go into the OR.
How old were you?
I was in high school, so this was like in 85, and then like my first year in college, 86. Yeah. DDA was already a couple years ahead, so he knew some of the people.
Right.
And then they were doing some of the bands that were playing downtown here at the Laundromat, and then later were playing at Squeaky's Tip Top.
See, you know more about the scene before I was old enough to get it. Like when I came along, Brian Brownlee had the Bob on 8th Street, and we had a little band, and he let us practice in there, and we were trying to open for your brother. For Desolate James.
That was the name of our band, You told me this story.
Yeah.
I might have not been in the band at this time.
You weren't. David was.
And David Swanigan was the drummer because I was trying to finish school, and I was playing with Howard Mary and Vic Baker and Shoefly Pie.
Okay.
So that was going more that, and Desolate James kind of got a little heavier. And
What
happened with that opening gig?
So we were...
You told me this, and you said it in DDA's accent, and it was, man.
We were practicing one day, and we just were working up covers. We had a couple of little originals, but we were just learning covers. And this one day, we were trying to learn Drop Dead Legs by Van Halen. We never even got it done, but DDA comes strolling in the place, just looking like it was random, but, a couple week or so later, I saw him and I said, What's up, DDA, man? We were trying to open for you guys. And, I was talking to Haley and what's happening? He goes, we were thinking about letting you guys open, Then I came down to rehearsal on Saturday and you guys were doing like Van Halen or something. And that's not cool. It's like, man, come on.
It wasn't progressive.
It wasn't punk rock, And I said, man, we don't even do that song. We were just trying to play it, man. He was like, I don't think we're going to be able to do that.
Oh, man. So who was that? Was with Travis and Brian?
That was with Dan Rigdon and a guy named Eric Mainpaw and a guy named Jason Stark.
Awesome.
And that was a fun little deal. We did like some Chili Peppers and some Beatles and some Stray Cats. And Living Color was out. Is 91. And we did three shows. We played with Flinghammer.
Yes.
They were like a funk rock thing.
Was at the Bob.
At the Bob, yeah.
Right.
And we played with Smile and Wicked Generation, which I guess one of those bands became 100 Year Son.
That's right. I think.
And then Dave Bradbury maybe was in Smile. And then we played with 1261, which fast forward a year. Once again, my brother was working at Riverside Glass, and he worked with a guy, Mike Wargo, who was in 1261. He used to tell Mike about me. And Mike used to just kind of, just blow it off because he was thinking, there's no way this guy has a brother who we want in our band. My brother, man, you check out my brother, man. He's fucking, he's badass on guitar. And Mike was like, whatever. Well, finally, they got so desperate. They'd been through a few guitar players, and Bentley Rhodes had left the band, and they were looking for somebody. And so finally, Mike just kind of just relented and said, tell him to come down. And so my brother calls me. It's like 9 in the morning, and I said, hello. He said, look here, wake up. I said, I'm awake. He said, I talked to Mike. They said, you can come down and jam with him and try out for that band. So you need to do it. I said, okay. Don't tell me, okay, you going to do it? I said, I'll do it. He said, and this time I had like a Fender Twin and Blackface Super Reverb and a Bandmaster. And he said, bring everything. I said, I don't need to bring all that shit. He said, you got to come in there strong. And so I loaded up 3 amps and we went down. They practiced on Jones Street behind the firehouse. And I went in there and and met them and everything. And they, you know, I'm from South Augusta. They're all from the West Side. So never the twain shall meet. And they asked something, they asked me to play something, I think Little Wing, which I knew. And I went into it and
they're like, dang, I can play.
And then they showed me a couple of their original things or whatever. And then Mike was like, as far as I'm concerned, you're in the band. And so that was that deal.
And the name of that band?
That was 1261.
Yep.
And the singer in that band, Scott Jones, we ended up, he kind of quit, or we kind of, he and I just really didn't click at all. And that's what's so ironic is that he is who got me the gig with James Brown after we kicked him out of the band.
Wow.
You know, it's like, you know,
no hard feelings.
A burnt bridge. It was like a year after, you know, that band had broken up. We went on without him. Grady, the other guitar player, I figured out he was the original singer. And so I was like, just let him sing. And because we were just, Scott was on a different page. You know, we just weren't clicking, weren't doing things at the same pace. And so we went on without him, and we made a little record. Of course, the band broke up. Mm-hmm. You know, we recorded at Dave Bradbury's. That's the, you know, the best, quickest way to break up a band is record or make a record. And and so Wargo got his dream of being an In Like Flynn. And then I was just doing nothing, working at Applebee's. And you know, I've told the rest of the story.
And then that's the story when
Scott and this guy, Victor, had told the interview. Maria Moon, who worked at James Brown's office, and I called her, and the rest is
I think that story people know, you know, and I don't want to get into it like we were talking about, you know. Yeah. And you did that, and it's amazing to think that. How many years were you with Mr. Brown?
12
years.
94 until the end, 2006.
Yeah. So your age, how old were you during that time?
I was 20 when I started. And, you know, I was just, I didn't think anything about trying. I had just gotten into James Brown around the time I met you, you know, 91, 92. And, you know what it was like back then as far as the local attitude about James Brown was very disdainful.
For sure. You know,
nobody cared anything about it. And this is right when he was getting out of prison.
Yeah.
And there was a big thing in the paper. These key things all happened that made me interested. Like my mom, when she'd be getting ready for work in the morning, she'd have the radio on BBQ or whatever. And then occasionally they'd play I Feel Good. And she would just go nuts when that song would come on. She was a morning person, you know. And she would just, and so it was always something I knew from that. And then I was going down the road one day. I was riding with this girl, Tracy Ellis, and it came on the radio, and I was a musician at this point, and I heard it with musician ears.
Right.
You know, and it was like mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Like, this is amazing.
That's funny you say that, because it's the same time period in the early 90s when, you know, I started DJing at Squeaky's.
Right.
And it was fun just to play dance records.
Yeah.
Loud, with my SB2 PV speakers in the tip top, and
it was heavy ass speakers.
Sounded good. And that's when I started listening to Mr. Brown and realizing how amazing those songs were, and they are, listening to them loud with good bottom, mid highs, with a lot of people, and watching people just react to the songs.
Right.
And then just kind of hearing it. And at the same time, a lot of hip hop was coming. And
all of it was sampling. It. Yeah.
It was all sampling Brown. So it was kind of like when you hear these tracks and it's like, oh, that's so-and-so. And that's, I know that's James Brown.
Right.
And my love just, it was instant, you know, when I was DJing Mr. Brown, and it just kind of.
I mean, this is also you think like when he was locked up for 2 years, that's right when sampling really took off, and the law had not caught up to it yet.
Right.
So they just,
all of it. You listen to so much stuff,
him, you know, and like How You Like Me Now. Mm-hmm. You know, that came from James Brown, a very obscure version of a James Brown. And then
Eric B. and Rakim, to me, man, their first record had, like, every song was a James Brown sound.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was amazing. You know, De La did it. So many, yeah, you know, that was that. And
I've got a funk encyclopedia. It's 20 years old. And it's on the in the James Brown entry, in every entry, it's got selected samples. And it's two columns per page, you know, of the song and what sampled it. And, like, just Funky Drummer is, like, four pages, just small print, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And the payback, same thing.
Right, right.
And so this has also coincided with his catalog getting put on CD. The box set came out in 91. I got that. And
you're talking about Star Time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah, when I bought that CD set, it was kind of like listening to it. All of it just blew me away.
Yeah. I mean, one Christmas I got that and the Aretha Franklin box set and the Elvis box set. And so that was like, and the Motown box set, you know, and so that was when, and the Stax, I got the nine CD Stax box. That's when I was really turning away from rock and roll and, like, getting into
the funk.
And it was a just incredible time, you know. I mean, I would just ruin parties. Like, if I went to somebody's party, I would just hijack the stereo and make them listen to James Brown, you know, and people, kids were like, what is wrong with you? You know, like, it got to be like, I was like, yeah, here he comes.
Here he comes. That's it. No, you know? I loved it when you were, you know, listen to this, listen to this, check out this track, listen to this part. And, I was just always like, wow, Keith is doing, you know, living the dream.
I don't remember if it was the first time I met you, but it was at Ray Gun, and it was some kind of, there was some skater kids. My little brother was skating or something. And you were in there, and you were like, you like James Brown? I said, yeah. He was like, yeah, me too. And you had Hot Pants, like, on vinyl. You had the album. And I was like, finally, I'm not alone.
That's right.
You know, there's one other guy in town. And then, you know, and then you started talking about doing the Soul Bar right when I got the gig, the Soul Bar opened.
Right, right. And we did that in his honor, thinking that Augusta, Georgia needed, if we're going to have a bar, we should have, you know, the Soul Bar in honor of Mr. Brown. And because of my, you know, just DJing so much at the time, you know, that's kind of how we opened up the bar with, you know, DJing and playing a lot of Brown and a lot of, you know, music. And it was just so fun to have that. And then to have him come in and have the band members come in, you know, bring posters and things to us and stuff.
But, tell me, what about that time he came in? What happened with that?
I mean, it was amazing just coming in, and he was like, oh, you got a pool table back there. And he wanted to show us how to play pool. And he was a bad man, though, on the pool table.
Was he good?
You know? Oh, yeah.
Wasn't he in pajamas or something weird?
That was another time he came in. Yeah, he had on his silk pajamas and his and a cowboy hat, and came in. He wanted a Coors Light. He was passing out some flyers for a restaurant on East Boundary. And
World of Ribs.
That was it, I think, yeah. And he got his thing, and he had his car in the front and drove off.
Yeah.
And everybody was like, he had a cowboy hat on, and his hair was down. And it was like, was that Mr. Brown? It was like, yeah, sure was. You know, he kind of did his thing and took off, and it was just, yeah. But it was always nice to see him in Augusta and to, you know, be invited to different rehearsals and concerts here in town. And, you know, the Comcast Connect Live Christmas, things were always fun. That was the last time I saw him. And, you know, he was not feeling well that last time I saw him. That's one of the first times I saw him where he just wasn't energetic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a week later he passed.
Yeah. And that was I saw that on TV. You know, like, being around him, you didn't see it as much as when I saw him on that show, and I was like, ooh, it didn't look so good. And I was gonna, the last time I would have seen him would have been at the toy giveaway. Mm-hmm. But we were rehearsing at Frank Trautman had this practice room on Ellis Street, and we had Larry John Wilson over there. We were doing the show, and I was going to go, and I waited too long, and he had left. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing was, you know, the phone call or whatever.
What I find amazing is that there were gigs on the book. Y'all had some shows New Year's Eve.
We had, yeah.
There was a lot of shows, you know.
And going to Canada for a week.
Yeah.
And then I got the call that we were – not, we were postponing leaving by a couple of days. And I said, oh, Miss Hogan called me. And she goes, oh, he's okay. He's all right. He's just going to get checked out and everything. I said, okay.
Well, yeah, that's a heavy, heavy story. Yeah. And we're going to end it on this today, Keith, but we're going to have you back so we can kind of go from then and then to kind of what you've been doing, you know, post Mr. Brown. I know you've been doing a lot of stuff with Going South. Want to talk about that? I know the current things that you're doing, anything you're doing. I want to know what you're doing, and we'll get you back here for sure. And we're going to go out with the track that we had as our intro that we're using that you created. Tell us a little bit about it, and I'm going to fade it in. I appreciate y'all hanging out with us on the Alma podcast. Keith Jenkins.
This is just a track I did in GarageBand, and it was for something else, and I just had this, I never got any vocals on it, and I had this funk track. And then I just went through and sampled his voice and made my own little James Brown record. I played it for him. He liked it. But the music is all me, and I just sampled him.
Yeah, this track is really, really good. And
I did all these vocals in the airport in Iceland. Sat there.
What program were you using?
Just GarageBand.
There you go.
Comes with every Mac.
Yeah. Keith, thanks again for coming and hanging out with me.
Wait a minute.
Wait.
I'm just getting started. We'll talk about the music.
Listen to this part right here at 808. Hand claps. You know I love the hand claps. Who's doing the horns?
That was Holly and Leroy Harper. We did those in a hotel room.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I hope we can get some of the band back together.
I want to give a shout out to my man Jerry Poindexter. He's in L.A. He's just had a series of strokes. I just found, just talked to him before I got here. He sounded good. He sounded all right. And he was my main partner in the group.
Yeah.
And so prayers for him.
Yeah. Shout out to Pee Wee Ellis also.
Pee Wee Ellis. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
I could just talk about
Pee Wee for forever. I mean, like, he was responsible for so much. It was at the peak period of Brown in the late 60s.
Right, right.
Cold Sweat, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And then went on Van Morrison, just a genius.
Yep.
True genius.
Yep. And also one more shout out to Mr. Danny Ray.
Danny Ray.
Sharpest dressed man in the room, yeah. Always.
Yeah.
Love Mr. Ray.
Yeah, that was another one.
Keith. Rough. Yeah, man. Hey, we'll talk more, and thanks for coming. Glad you came.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it. Yeah, I like this microphone.
Sounds good.
I really want these headphones.
Man. Augusta Podcast, y'all. Check them out.
Augusta Podcast. Thank y'all. Oh, that's me on the organ. Forgot I did. I didn't know I gave you the organ version.